I'm Catherine Christeller. I'm the executive director and the founder of the Chicago Women's AIDS Project, which is a relatively small and getting smaller with funny cuts organization providing HIV services, both prevention and care, in Chicago. And we serve both all three areas of Chicago, North Side, South Side, and West Side. I personally started the agency in 1988, and so it's been 22 years of working with HIV-positive women. We do support groups and mental health, and in prevention, we try to innovate programs that serve communities at high risk. We've been in the STD clinics for 19 years, which is kind of amazing, and I'm talking here about a newer program that we started to work with women coming out of jail or prison. I have no conflicts of interest or disclosures to make. Sorry, I didn't put it up there. Although I will say that I am personally against healthcare for profit. That's my disclosure. We shouldn't be making profit over illness, and I am an avid advocate for universal health care, what we call single payer sometimes, or what's probably better, Medicare for all. So please join me in supporting that if you can. Back to our topic. We really wanted to do something about serving incarcerated women, and we started talking about with the jail in Cook County, which is the biggest jail in the country. We sort of go neck and neck with L.A., depending on how you count the numbers. And, you know, I think people probably know that the number of incarcerated women has really exploded since the 1980s, that this explosion sort of came after the initial mass incarceration of men. And in fact, the numbers and rates are actually higher now for women. So we're playing catch up here, unfortunately. And that women are at very high risk for HIV. And so again, people may not know that women inmates are 15 times more likely to be HIV positive than women in the general population, but also that women's HIV rates are higher than the rates for men in prison. A little surprising there. The other thing that really struck us is that 80% of the women who were involved in what we'll euphemistically call criminal justice, although it's not really justice, that they are really in the community. So they're on parole, they're on probation, furlough program, they're in and out of the system. And so there's really a bigger set of people affected by this in the community than there is in the actual institutionalized setting. In Chicago, women return to a certain set of communities on the South and West Side that have very, very high rates of concentrated poverty. And obviously where there's a lot of men who are being incarcerated. This cycle of abuse, which is frequently interpersonal violence, abuse as a child, sexual abuse, is very much associated with incarceration, addiction, trauma, poor mental health, and then incarceration over and over again, is a very hard cycle to break. And most public health advocates go at it from the end of how can we go into these institutions and improve health care. And of course, that is tremendously important. It's actually the only place, by the way, that you have the right to health care in our society. We have to provide health care. It's ironic, isn't it, in prisons and jails. But of course, it doesn't mean we do it well. We don't. And so a lot of advocates look at, you know, can we do STI screening? Can we do HIV prevention? What are we doing with transitional care? And there's a lot of really good projects. There's, you know, tremendous amount of advocacy. But I would raise the question of should we be tearing down our institutions of incarceration instead? based on what we see. And I'll end with that point. So we started this, we created this project called Sisters Reaching Out, and it we looked around for a model to use. People here don't do HIV work, is that, I gather? Some do? Okay, so one of the big programs for women that the CDC was promoting, they changed their mind recently, but they were promoting something, a DEBI, they call it, an effective behavioral intervention, called SISTA. And interestingly, it turns out that when they developed SISTA, all drug-using women were eliminated from the sample. So it wasn't developed for women who have both sexual risk and drug-related risks. And so that's why we, I know, isn't it weird? she's cocking her head at me. It's astounding. I know. And they don't tell people that, but they really did. And it doesn't have harm reduction. And so we were very committed to teaching harm reduction in our project. And it didn't, SISTA doesn't have that around, needles and, other aspects. So we used SHIELD, which is a newer behavioral intervention, way too long, so we had to shorten it, and then we had to make it gender-specific, because any HIV, STI intervention for women has to be gender-specific. So we ended up with four regular workshops on your, sort of traditional health education content, two workshops that are on leadership skills, and communication skills. Originally, we were trying to offer case management. We've eliminated that from the program, sadly, because it's very hard to implement. There's in the SHIELD intervention, there's two mandatory outreach assignments. So women coming into the program in order to graduate have to go out and teach what they've learned to some group of people or individuals, and they get to choose where that is. And basically the evaluation I'm talking about here was a very small sample of women in the first three cycles. And so we've gone on to recruit more women, but we were funded to do the evaluation for that first starting point. I regret that because the sample is tiny, so I'm warning you that the data is kind of hard to interpret because it's so small. But basically what we found was incentives were obviously critical to getting women, very impoverished women, with a lot of stress in their lives, mostly living in transitional programs in recovery homes, to come in. They needed an incentive and lunch and bus cards, and we did all of that. We also hired somebody who herself had come out of the jail system and had become a recovery advocate and was well known in the community. We offered makeup sessions, so you could make up any workshop session that you missed if you did it within the 3-month period, and that was also very critical to getting a high completion rate. And we created a sort of social community for women. They could come in and use our computers, they could come in and use the phones, and these are scarce resources if you're in the transitional living community. And they could come in and talk to staff, when they need it. Okay, these are the folks who helped us create the curriculum. This is our leadership council. All of these women are women coming out of the jail or prison system and who volunteered their time and to actually critique what we had developed. And they were just thrilled to have this role. And it was just very empowering for them to feel like that they were being listened to and that this was, that this was something that they were going to take leadership on. And they were very sad that they couldn't be in the research project then. it was like, what? I can't be in the first cycle. So these are, I'm probably going to zoom over this. These are the, what our evaluator helped do. We did a pre-test, post-test, 6-month follow-up, which was very hard to do. And so we had a struggle with that. And basically, we obviously looking at, you know, demographics for this population, and did a descriptive analysis of that. But we were also trying to look at behavior change, both condom use and currently and intentions in the future to use condoms. And, you know, that's, you know, obviously a key issue around HIV prevention. We also did focus groups on what, you know, ask with, again, with these independent evaluators to find out what people liked and didn't like about the program. We did recruit women who clearly represent the population we were trying to target. One concern was our choice to go do, which I sort of skipped over, is that we were originally going to do this program in the jail, and then we realized that you really couldn't retain and get 100% completion. We wanted everyone to complete the program and get a certificate and have even the most minimal credential coming out of that. This, do you know what I mean? It's slightly fake credential. It's not, you know, it's not an academic credential. It's not even a Board of Health credential, but it's something. And we wanted them to have a success and complete it. And we couldn't do it in the jail. Basically, people just are arbitrarily are released so frequently and with no notice that you get very little completion. Plus, there's a lot of other workshop-based programs going on, so it would be very hard for us to measure effectiveness. So as you can see, this is a population with a lot of problems. Very few are working, and the majority cite that the major barrier to work for them is their felony record. And that's it's also an aging population, interestingly, although we do have a wide age range. We've had a 19-year-old in the program. We've had, at the upper end, probably a 60-year-old in the program. And some of the findings, again, this is maybe not as important to people who are not in HIV, but basically we were able to see some changes that we can't really do a statistical analysis on just such a small sample. But we were, you know, saw a trend that women reported less unprotected sex with casual and exchange partners, but that the change with their main partner was not there, that was really hard to change condom use with main partner. And all of our questions, we indicated those three types of partners. The casual partner is what the women call friend with benefits. Those categories came from the women, and they really, as you know, they really wanted, you know, they said that's, you know, the types of partners. Right. Very few women self-identified as working in the sex trade. But of course, almost all of them had. You know, and it's just that wasn't their self-identification to say I'm in prostitution or whatever. The substance use data is very difficult because basically people don't want to report drug use. So it really didn't work. Do you know what I mean? This was anonymous. It was coded, et cetera. But folks really didn't. You know, that was a problem. This is a little, a graphic representation of some of the condom, behavior change data. Basically there was some change pre and post test. And by and large, what we saw most dramatically was the change with the exchange partners, that there was increased intention and actual use of condom to some extent with exchange partner. Intention, it's not great, but with the small sample and with losing people pre, post, and then at 6 months, it's hard to follow the exchange. What's interesting, in the follow-up, the people we did follow up with at 6 months said they had no exchange partners. So I don't know. I like to run a much bigger thing to see if that's, you know, really true, really happening. The other thing that was interesting is 5 minutes. Okay, I gotta move. We promote female condoms aggressively, and we train women to be female condom promoters in the community. We train community women. And interestingly, we definitely saw an increase in folks saying that they intended to use female condoms, and including with their main partner. So some of the things that are relevant here is that very, very few have health insurance, both pre- and post-program. That didn't change, not surprising. We saw an increase in job training attendance and an increase in school enrollment, probably GED, but we did not see an increase in employment. And so none of the women who were graduated, who we were following, were full-time employed. We also did not see a change in housing, that they were living in transitional housing when they came in to our prevention program, and then at 6 months they were still living in not necessarily the same transitional housing, but in some transitional housing. All of the women, it obviously was mandatory, but they all did report on their health promotion activities and reported that they were very comfortable doing health promotion. So some of the things that we felt were successful was the high retention and the outreach component, which was the health promotion component. And the women were very frank. They had to fill out a sheet explaining who they had done their presentation to, and what were the topics they had covered and where they had done it. And a lot of them surprisingly reported talking to their mothers, their daughters, their cousins, their friends, and their partners with very frank discussions, some of them challenging. For instance, one woman challenged her mother, saying, you know your partner's running around. Don't tell me he's faithful to you. You know, very, very open discussions that really wouldn't have happened, I don't think, I can't prove it, but wouldn't have happened without them having this assignment and having this new confidence. And so some of the things, sorry, it needs a little editing here. Some of the things they said was that they were really surprised that they were able to do it. They felt that they were now of service to the community, and they felt that their families thought of them differently because they were now a certified health promoter. And I didn't include, I have a fabulous picture of graduation. We do a big graduation for every 3 months for whoever's graduated in those cycles. And they're amazing. People dress up. They bring their family. Sometimes bring their grandkids and the siblings. And it's and you can really see that the family, there's a sense of pride. I've completed something. So this is some of this risk stuff, that basically saying that we don't know what to do about the long-term partners, that we need some better risk reduction strategies, maybe increased testing. It's not clear because condom use isn't really happening with long-term partners. And basically that we saw that these women were more likely to say they had had job training at 6 months, but in reality, it's job readiness. It is not job training. And so they're just readiness forever. You know, you guys probably know that. And so the women are saying to us, can't you get me a job? And, of course, we're funded to do HIV prevention. You know, so I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know, we're doing the wrong thing here. The things we've added since the evaluation was done, we added two peer workers who are graduates of the program, and they do the outreach for the program now, and that's very exciting, and that really made recruitment more consistent because we discovered you can't do recruitment agency to agency. You have to go face-to-face to the recovery homes with the outreach worker saying, this is a great program. Come into it. Now, we did have to sort of caution her. She was over-promising that they would get a certificate, therefore they could get a job like her. And I'm like, no, this is not true. I know. So, but you could see, you know, she really understood why people wanted to come. So basically, without funding, it's very difficult to take the next step. and to employ more graduates as health promoters. Clearly, I would argue to the prevention community and that formerly incarcerated women not only can do programs, peer programs in the jails, which have been done, but they can also do it in the community. And they're reaching community members who are very high risk, who are not going to come to our interventions. Okay, and so I think that's one message we need to give to the CDC and the funders that hey, there's a community effect going on here because there's an increasing trend to make HIV prevention clinical and maybe one-on-one kind of thing and do it in big institutions, medical care, and you're not going to reach the people these women reach, i.e. their partners who use or men who use drugs. Their mothers and their women who are in the recovery home with them, you know, who clearly have the same risks. Basically, I think women, you know, obviously we learned that women want to be part of the solution. I got to wrap up. And so my final point is to say basically we're transitioning people to nowhere with transitional services, that there is no, they're not going to permanent housing, they're not going to real employment, they're just cycling around this so-called transition, and so we kind of need to stop pretending here. That health education is necessary, but not sufficient at all to interrupt the cycle of relapse, incarceration, and poor health outcomes. And finally, we need to end mass incarceration. And that's the true public health solution. So, no, my data doesn't tell you that. But basically, I discovered that we are the problem. You know, incarcerating people, basically giving them a felony record, means that they will be permanently at high risk for poor health because they can't get work and they can't get stable housing and they can't even get public benefits many times unless they can get disability. And they can't, for instance, live in the public housing. So stopping the arresting of people instead of trying to go to jail and make it healthier, let's stop sending people to jail. Thank you. Oh, that's my funder. I had the Chicago Department of Health funded this project.
And we have 2 minutes of questions for this presentation. And then we'll open it up.
Hi. I'm just curious, to what extent the women, while they were in the training, in addition to talking to mothers, sisters, cousins, and boyfriends, were they able to do it in the transitional living?
Yes, so some...
Where they were, like, organizing little small groups.
Right. I would like to do more now that we've tried this, you know, to sort of get, you know, more documentation on that and also structure it more. So we asked them to fill out a sheet, but, you know, it's but yeah, they could do it to a group, and obviously the groups they have access to are in their living situation. So when I looked at, and it was that data wasn't really looked at by our evaluators, so I looked at it for just this past year, for 2011, before coming here, and yes, there definitely, it didn't seem like there were other groups. It was either family, friend, partner, or recovery home situation, and I think that, for those who did it, that they were very nervous about it, and then felt very validated that they had information to share.
So is that something that you would, in the future, maybe focus on more and help people feel more prepared for it?
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to do a curriculum, and so they were not really given a curriculum, which we would need to really work on that issue. The interesting thing, though, about the one-on-one is that when I read there, they had to write how they felt about the experience, and the comments were very much around challenging, in the one-on-one conversations, challenging people's perception that they weren't at risk. Now, that's very useful when you have a peer challenging someone, you know, a woman challenging another woman saying, hey, your partner's out there, you know what I mean? And the woman's saying, no, he's not, and they're debating that. That's something that you're, you know, a nurse isn't going to be able to do. But the other thing about the groups is that we did send them with kits. So we sent them with, say, if they were going, you know, for whoever they were going to do, we sent them with our safer sex kits like we use in the STD clinics, including the female condoms. And that was a big topic of discussion, is the female condom as an option. If you don't like male condoms, hey, try this. So please start including female condoms in your work.
Thank you very much. One more round of applause for everyone.